Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Square Ball Podcast.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. It's brought to you in association with West Yorkshire Electrical, the Monday show, wyelectrical.co.uk for details. Find them on social media as well. Don't just do stuff with wires in. They do roofs, don't they?
They do roof work with wires or without wires.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're having it done, you might as well have to put some wires into and get some solar panels and that.
Yeah, that's exactly.
And speak to them and they'll sort that.
That's the expert advice, isn't it?
From me, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. If it has wires in it, they'll work with it. Specialists in all things electrical and specialists in renewables as well. So do battery storage, EV chargers, all the full shebang. You know about electrics, presumably at this stage.
I do, yeah. But maybe the listeners don't.
wyelectrical.co.uk for details. Hello, Phil. Hey, so we're recording this. It's 6:30 on Sunday evening now. We thought we would steal a march on this one and find out what it was like in the press box today, because that's the sort of theme, the loose theme of this show is the view from the press box. How was it for you? How was Daniel Farke in the post-match then?
Well. It's tight at the top, isn't it? And a hell of a lot tighter than I thought it was going to be at this stage. One of the things we got onto chatting about with him afterwards, the press conference, was whether or not he genuinely thought at the end of December, when it was 17 points to Leicester, whether he thought that gap could be bridged. And he said that he didn't really give it much thought at that point, which may or may not be true, but was honest enough to say that had he given it a lot of thought and had he seriously considered the chances of that, to use his words, unrealistic, you know, partly because Leicester were so good, partly because that is a massive, massive gap to bridge and not easy to do. And also because I don't think at the end of December we were seeing in Leeds necessarily the capability to be as reliable as they've become. I mean, they've been a machine since the turn of the year. They're just bulldozing through fixtures. And I thought that today was just trademark Farke Leeds, really. It wasn't showy, it wasn't massively comprehensive in the sense of running to 3-4-5-0. But there was very little in the game for Millwall, even though they started to take risks in the second half. There weren't that many occasions where you really felt like they were seeing the whites of Melier's eyes. Leeds just had, again, those slivers of class that made the difference. And that is why, time after time, managers like Neil Harris today are sitting down and saying, A, we can't realistically compete with this or hope to beat this sort of team over and over again because they just are too good. B, this is why Leeds are probably going up, because they play like this. They have these players. They have guys like Nonto, who contributed very little before Christmas but is now scoring at a healthy rate. Guys like James, who's up to almost 20 goals and assists combined. Ruta, who's almost up to 20 assists alone, which is completely ridiculous. Just that element and that degree, which is very hard to compete with if you're a mid-table club or a club fighting relegation, and actually has become really difficult to compete with if you're right up at the top too.
It's interesting, isn't it, how like the strain of the season is perhaps it's impacted other clubs a little bit more than Leeds to this point. Again, caveat everything by saying there is a long way to go. But on the evidence so far, and again, it goes back to what Farke was saying about it all playing out as he thought it would. He's been around this block so many times, and that's bringing so much assurance, I think, to the fans, isn't it?
The thing is, there isn't that long to go, is there? It's almost April, 8 matches left, and there's enough scope in there for the table to change pretty dramatically, and you would find it very hard to call at the moment. The one thing you have to say, and I think people on the outside looking in will feel this, is that Leeds have the momentum. Ipswich actually have found themselves a really good spell of form again. And if it hadn't been for what happened to them away at Cardiff, you know, they'd be on a really long streak of wins themselves. But Leeds have the momentum and they have the impetus. And Farke is probably, of the three managers at the top, probably the one who'll be kind of least happy about this break coming around. I think he can see the value of a breather, and I think it'll be good for Leeds actually to be able to draw breath. But you don't generally tend to choose to take a bit of respite when you don't need it, which Leeds don't at the moment. The problem for Leicester and Ipswich and also Southampton as well is that they can't really intervene with this. One of two things is going to happen now. Either Leeds carry on the way they're going, in which case it's not going to be feasible to stop them, or they're going to drop off and this form is going to elude them again. But that's not going to happen because of anything that Leicester or Ipswich are able to do, because they won't play Leeds again this season. And Southampton don't come to Elland Road until the last weekend. Hard to know what's going to be on that game. They're very much reliant on somebody from further down the table putting a spoke in the wheel, which just to this point hasn't looked like happening.
You say Farke might not welcome the break. I almost sense that he does. I think it almost seems to me to be factored into his thinking.
I think the reason why actually it's not the big help that it could be is because a lot of players will be away and a lot of players will play during it.
Yeah.
He won't get much in the way of full training sessions with the squad. I often wonder how much that really matters when you get down to the back end of March and early April, because you've drilled the players so much to this point and they understand the tactics inside out. So, you know, it's more about maintaining fitness and managing load and everything else, and obviously preparing for different clubs that you play against individually from a tactical perspective. But, you know, I don't think it handicaps Leeds massively that they won't necessarily be able to do a huge amount of preparation for Watford away. But as Farke said today, it's likely that Firpo will miss that game. He's going to be away with the Dominican Republic. And I don't think he's due back until that Friday. Certainly that's what Farke was saying. So that means a change to that position in the team. And whether or not you rate Firpo or you want him at left back or whatever else, the results speak for themselves. The team as it is at the moment is really settled and is going along nicely. So I suspect you're right. I think the whole sofa, coffee and cake thing from Farke is a fair reflection of how he feels. I think it's been really busy to this point and he'll feel the need for a bit of a break, a chance to draw breath. And you know, this is the last chance before you kind of go for the line. But at the same time, it's probably not an ideal fortnight, this. And you never really find that managers who are going along in the way that Leeds are, you know, have teams that are going along in the way that Leeds are, particularly want the games to stop.
I've just looked back at the Bielsa season, actually, and a nice bit of symmetry. 9 games from the end of that, we played Neil Harris's Cardiff. That was the same. So it's the same sort of point of the season. Obviously, then it was a weirdly compressed post-COVID part where every game was played within about a month, wasn't it, after that? So that felt very intense, whereas we've got ages to wait to be promoted now.
Yeah, I think the psychological angle of it, which we spoke about on the show, like previewing this weekend, shouldn't be underestimated. The fact that they can go into this break and point to the table and say we're top of it. And you know, Leicester, they have the game in hand and may well win it. But from a, like I say, psychological point of view, saying that we've finally made it to the summit, we've reeled you in over all this time, I think is really significant. But also I was going to say, from a psychological point of view, just breaking up the routine of it as well. Like the amount of sort of travel training that they've had to deal with in the last sort of month or two, just to take all the repetition out of that, the steam out of that, the wind out of those sails. And just, so even if players are going away to play for Wales or whatever, it's a different kind of travel. It's a different company. It's, you know, it's a different setup. It's not just doing that same thing over and over again in that same bubble. I think
that's true.
There's definitely an important angle there.
Well, Farke, afterwards, I was quite fascinated really to see how he approached it afterwards, because you'll have seen his reaction to the second goal when it went in. He doesn't tend to show...
What did he do? I didn't say I haven't seen
it. He's punching the air. You know, it's kind of display of emotion that you don't often get from Farke or not like that. He said afterwards, and I suspect this is right actually, he said the second goal was important because we needed it. You know, they needed it to go top, but they needed it in the game as well, irrespective of what it was doing to the table. The crowd could tell that 1-0 was not a good position at that point. Millwall were starting to gamble a bit. The changes helped them.
They were getting some bodies forward, weren't they?
But yeah, it became a handful and quite difficult. But again, you know, a little bit like that spell of the game where Norwich were on top at Elland Road. There wasn't a lot coming from it. You know, it wasn't as if you felt like Melier was permanently on the edge of conceding. But he did say, Farke, you know, we do need to enjoy this to a degree, being top of the table, because you work for it and you work hard for it. And if you don't enjoy or take the satisfaction of what that leads to and what you achieve, then what's the point? You know, as he put it, one day you look back and think, well, why did we all slog ourselves in the way that we did if when we got to the table, we were all very matter of fact and, you know, straight-laced about it.
That's true, yeah.
But at the same time, he said, you know, it's important that you don't get distracted. I asked him, and I think this is a fair question, really, whether or not he thinks Leeds are now best placed to finish this off. Because I suspect at the moment, if you did a straw poll of people who follow the Championship closely, including you two, I think most people would probably say, well, nobody looks like they're in better shape at the moment. And I think, to look at this from Leicester's perspective, just briefly, I think it's really difficult to rationalise the loss of a 17-point gap. Like, that's a massive advantage that you've thrown away. And I don't think that's very easy to explain in the sense of, you know, well, this is how it goes and sometimes things turn for the worse. That's a really, really massive, massive swing. But to repeat what I was saying on the podcast before today's game, they haven't done a right lot wrong, Leicester. You know, even this run where I think it's 11 points they've dropped in five games, like the Championship does that to everybody sooner or later. There's always a period of the season where that happens. And they're still on 82 points in the way that Ipswich are on 81 as well. It's just uniquely competitive, this. And it's still too close to call, I think.
No, absolutely, yeah. Well, like I say, it just feels nice. We've seen a nice win with a nice team. I think that we all quite like now. That's all settled down, hasn't it? The relationship between the crowd and the players. I was thinking about that today, actually, when the game was going on, that the players have all got songs now. Whereas at the start of the season, it was just kind of, what's this season going to bring? What's it going to look like? You're a little Judas bastard because you went out. You want out. We're never quite sure about Sinisterra. He went. Nonto made the noises to leave. And suddenly, Nonto scoring crucial goals. There are songs for, I mean, obviously we know about the Nonto song, something we don't need to get into. Mm. But I'm thinking like Ampadu, Firpo, all these different players.
Also, you're back in the division that you took so long and worked so hard to get out of, and nobody wanted to be back in. And it goes without saying that if you're in the Championship, you can sign players that you want to, and that you, I mean, as you saw in the Bielsa era, players that you'll remember for life and players that you'll respect for life. But you don't get the truly elite players in the Championship. You know, your best footballers like Rafinha and others are what you get when you're in the Premier League and you've got the money to work with it. So I'm like you, I kind of wondered what the relationship would be like with the team and whether, as I've said previously, this would all feel a bit transactional. You know, like you just need to get out of this league, get it done. If we win lots of games, great. But in the end, it's all about where you're getting to. But I think that's changed. And I think people are enjoying it more than that. And you made this point, you know, when they went up in 2020, the City didn't get it properly. That they didn't get the experience of promotion properly. And I think it's important that you know, if that happens this time, that does occur. And, you know, you do it in the way that you're supposed to, as opposed to COVID-affected celebrations where they wheel out a bus purely for the purposes of people celebrating and then going home pretty quickly, which is what that was all about.
For the documentary and all that. Yeah, you know what? The closer it gets, the more it feels like it's within touching distance, the more I reflect back on 2020 and feel like I really missed out. At the time, I was all right with it because you weighed it up against what was happening with the pandemic, which was horrible. And, you know, we can't choose when we go up. All we can do is, you know, we want to go up at the earliest possible opportunity, don't we? You know,
I suppose what you would say, though, is that it was a totally unique period of time, wasn't it? It was different in a way that I don't think you'll ever see again. The way it was structured, the break in the season, the way in which the games had to be played, the absence of crowds. I'm not saying it was a good thing, but it was an absolutely unique promotion season. That, in a way that I think, and I wonder how Norwich looked back at Farke's two promotions, whether the second one felt very much like the first one. It certainly seemed to be easier, the second one. And I wonder whether that makes it seem like a bit more of a procession and, as I say, a bit more transactional, whereas with Bielsa in 2020, it just felt like every drop of blood, really, didn't it? Like that proper pound of flesh to get that done with some pretty remarkable football. But I think with Farker, people are always going to say the squad is there to win promotion, and it definitely is. But his management of it, I think, has been pretty superb. And the stat that jumps out at the moment is the fact that they haven't conceded from open play since December the 30th. I mean, that's ridiculously good. And granted, there are a lot of clubs in the Championship who don't offer a huge amount when it comes to attacking football, and certainly not at Elland Road. But even so, you know, to go back to what we're saying about Leicester and the fact that the Championship tends to do what it's doing to them at the moment to everybody at some stage, it's nigh on impossible to go through 3 months without conceding from open play.
Yeah, I think that, you know, whilst we do have the dice very much loaded in our favour in terms of, you know, squad and resources and parachute payments and all that, it's not our fault, is it? All we can do is enjoy what's in front of us, and I'm enjoying myself at the minute.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that they automatically all play well. And it doesn't mean that the changes you choose to make work. It doesn't mean that if you throw Bamford in for Pirro that suddenly solves whatever it is that isn't quite working. It doesn't mean that...
And we saw it at Stoke away, didn't we, actually? Yeah. How we really sort of struggled through that game. Yeah, and it was repeated definitely. A couple of times, wasn't it?
And Nonto, I think, is a really good example as well of just teasing him back into form from a period where his mind didn't seem right. You know, his attitude didn't seem to be there. It just seemed like a bit of an unhappy relationship. But suddenly he's coming up with goals like today's, which was an, you know, just absolute banger. And what was needed, because it's a pretty flat first half today.
Yeah, good though.
Well, yeah. But it's just trademark Farker and Leeds, I think.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I mean, we've been laughing on like the other shows, haven't we, Michael, about your requirement. Was it 27 goals, you said?
That was early in the season, I think, yeah.
Yeah,
I think
when it was angry a
completely
with
arbitrary.
Oh, well, in order to redeem himself. Yeah.
Mm. But I think...
That seems completely fair and rational.
I think the importance of the goals he scored this year are certainly getting us there. It feels like he's not just adding the third or anything, is he, the non-so? He's opening the score and he's scoring. He got the winning goal at Bristol, didn't he? And I feel like I don't know, he's playing a vital part in this.
It's interesting. I had a chat with somebody around New Year in the January window. Said I don't see the sense in retaining Nonto. I'd cash in on him and maybe reinvest it in two or three other players to get you up. And actually, you can see why it was worth making him stay.
To be quite honest, I think quite a lot of people seem to be fairly philosophical back in the summer. You know, when it got really kind of awkward between him and Leeds and that was at its height, I was getting the sense that a lot of people were thinking, well, you know, just take the money, just get rid of it. And I think that was a fair attitude at the time. And again, in January, he hadn't done much to that point. So the argument that if you take the money for Nonto and reinvest it, you might actually benefit was totally, totally valid. But there's a player who has been managed into form. And, you know, Dan James again today, it's easy to say, well, you know, they're not in the Premier League anymore, so James is more likely to have an impact and are more likely to be useful. But the criticism of James was always that he didn't have any end product. You know, he didn't create, he didn't score goals. He was quick and that was pretty much it. Well, you know, the stats say differently, and I don't think that happens by chance. I think that does come down to good culture, good atmosphere and good management.
It does look like Dan James has kind of finally settled, doesn't it? He looks a little bit more sure of himself and what he should be doing. He's always got that quizzical look on his face, Dan James, when after he's done something that hasn't quite worked out. But we've seen that less and less this season because he's coming up with end products. And do you think maybe, and this is something I think I floated on one of our shows, is that Farker is responsible maybe for simplifying things for him a little bit and telling him what he needs to do, where he should be, what is expected of him, which is to use his pace, drive towards goal, and try and come in on the back post, whatever it might be.
Yeah, and also to play out wide. I know Bielsa thought that James was a potential nine, but it never really seemed to work. And I think because, in particular, it was a season that wasn't going well when he came from Man United, it became tough for him because being used out of position and sometimes even being in position, it wasn't easy to make much of an impact, and it was all kind of falling apart round about him. I think there is quite a high level of simplicity in Farke's tactics, which I think benefits quite a lot of the players. It isn't, they don't take massive risks, and it isn't all gambled on, you know, kind of all out attacking football all the time. But I was writing this after the Sheffield Wednesday game and saying, even if you want to see Leeds be, you know, a bit more out there when it comes to the risks they are taking, or to, you know, to be a bit more adventurous, why would you when the form is like this? You know, when you're conceding so few goals and so, you know, virtually none from open play for this period of time anyway, why would you break from the model that's working so well?
I was going to say, all those clean sheets, only 28 goals conceded, best goal difference in the division. It's almost like he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, but Birmingham 4, Leeds 5 was exciting, wasn't it?
It was.
He'd very near killed me. But.
I suppose, you know, when it was a bit flat at Elland Road at the start of the season?
Yeah.
I think maybe, there was this kind of a, we were missing that kind of element of chaos and that emotional turmoil. Well, to a certain extent. We were addicted to it, I think.
To go back to the win over Millwall in that promotion season, they were two up, didn't they, in that? And it was a comeback and it was Pablo scoring and everything was, I don't know, everything was hyped up on it, but just going and winning 2-0 quite comfortably today, it was just nice.
You know, I think we spoke about this on the match ball, didn't we? Saying like the difference between that side and this side is that Leeds would have continued just bombing forward regardless at that point, whereas today they sometimes just broke the game up, put a foot on it, looked after the ball for a bit, slowed it down, you know, knocked it around between the centre-backs for a bit, dropped it into midfield, dropped it back and just try and draw the opposition on and stuff, whereas it would have been gung-ho. And it's not, that's not to, in any way, levels of criticism of that season, because it was absolutely amazing and I loved watching Bielsa's football.
Of course, it was brilliant.
But every type of football has weaknesses in it, doesn't it? And has its own shortcomings, whatever they may be.
Yeah, but you also have to have your own way. And I suspect the worst thing you could ever do at Leeds, or in general actually, is to try and copy what Bielsa does or emulate what Bielsa does or try to essentially be him. I think it's been quite telling that when Marsh was here, as an example, there was constant talk in press conferences and everything else about Bielsa. It came up all the time. It really hasn't much with Farke at all. And in fact, to be totally honest, the only time I can really think of that being mentioned was when he said himself, you know, like, we're ahead of that side when it comes to points per game or position after a certain number of fixtures. It was him who drew the comparison. And I think it probably says something about how, you know, how well respected he is by the crowd, that there isn't this constant thing of, well, Bielsa did this and Bielsa did that and this is how they played. You just got to take Farke's football on its own merits, and whether it's as exciting or not, you know, the results really do speak for themselves.
It's effective, isn't it? That's the thing.
It's effective, but I do think it's better than effective, don't you?
I think as well, what Farke's done is, in the same way Bielsa had to, was banish some really bad memories of what had gone before it. Because straight away with Bielsa came in, you were like, oh fine, we can forget about Heckingbottom and all that terribleness. And likewise, I think Farke's come in and just straight away you're like, oh, thank God it's not Marsh, thank God it's not Allardyce or Gracia, who was there for 5 minutes in the middle and felt fine for a couple of weeks.
Do you know, I think Gracia's football is actually quite similar to Farke's in what he was trying or not trying to do, but I think Farke's has a more defined tactical plan.
Yeah, I felt like Gracia's was more defensively minded than Farke's. Will be interesting. I think you get a far better comparison once you go up into the Premier League and if that happens. And you know, Farke has to decide how he's going to play, what he's going to do against sides who will try to dominate you and sides who you quite often can't stop dominating you, you know, like City and others. But it's not, I don't think it's negative Farke's football at all. And that sounds pretty obvious given how many goals they've scored and where they are in the league. I just think he sets limits on some of what they do, but for really, really good reason. And if you were saying to him, you should be doing this differently or that differently, he would just say, well, why?
Would you describe it more as like sensible attacking?
Pragmatic.
Yeah.
Would be a good word.
Like, we break a lot. A lot of it's predicated on the break, being effective at breaking and transitional plays, and we're dead good at that.
I also think it's not arrogant, you know, in the sense that it's not saying we've got all these attacking players, so let's just try and overrun Millwall and attack them to death and try and score 6 or 7 goals. I think you get enough out of the attacking players. And if you look at the goals scored and assists and everything individually across the squad, it's really, really impressive. So it's kind of like maximising the output, or at least getting very good output from them without trying to get too much. I just think the balance has been right. And I wouldn't say at the moment they're looking wildly fresh, Leeds. I think they've definitely had to find reserves of stamina through the past few weeks. But with the exception of the Leicester game, they haven't looked in much trouble either.
Yeah, and you can say to the players as well, like, like, you know, you've got to where we were setting out to get to at the start of the season, which would be top of the table. You've done that. And now the finishing line is in sight, and it's not something to be scared of. It's another 8 games left to play, and then you get to have a break and hopefully to celebrate your achievements. Yeah, I was going to ask, just talking about the sort of post-Bielsa thing, do you think we're finally emerging from his shadow? And we kind of addressed that in the point that we just discussed there. Not his shadow, but the shadow of that time and the expectations that came with it.
I would say so. It suddenly feels like a different era.
Because we felt rudderless afterwards. The stuff that we tried to do afterwards, just, you know, zigzagging from one thing to another, and it was all kind of underpinned by a lot of Victor Orta's whims. And whereas we're seeing now this very sort of systematic data-led approach from the 49ers and all the people that are in the club there on the playing side, and it's a huge number, isn't it?
I don't think that this squad was necessarily as easy to put together as people would assume. You know, there was a lot of movement needed in the summer. I wrote a couple of weeks ago about Nick Hammond and his role in the background doing all of this. And, you know, I've read a few people say, somebody tweeted me back after a piece I'd written. I think it might have been about Hammond, actually.
Put a picture of your bird on
No, here, sadly,
Phil.
Sadly not. It was saying they've got a Premier League squad, so they would get promoted. I don't think that's true at all. I don't think this is a squad that would, if you went up with this and played in the Premier League with this squad, I don't think it would necessarily stay up. But it's very, very good by Championship standards. That, as far as I'm aware, is the name of the game, isn't it? Build yourself a squad and a team that gets you out of the league.
And as we were saying last season, like, there's been too much looking steps down the road, I think, with Leeds at times. Let's get up and then figure out what we're going to do when we're there. And that's not to suggest that they shouldn't start planning for the various contingencies.
Absolutely. But the interesting comparison will be between what they do if they go up, what they do in the transfer market compared to what they did back in 2020 and the sort of subsequent seasons, to see whether some of their bets are a little bit safer, whether they go for a few more sure things rather than anything too out there. I mean, I have to say, some of the players that they did sign initially, you know, I do think there's a decent defender in Robin Koch. And when he came, he had good reputation. Germany international didn't seem like a stupid signing, that one. Likewise, Rodrigo in Spain. But the more you look at it, the more you just don't think that there was enough joined up thinking in what they were doing and the kind of next squad that they were trying to build.
Yeah. It's probably telling that this season there's not been a huge amount of upset about the squad, insofar as in the Bielsa season it was, well, the first one, it was we need a keeper and we got Kiko Casilla. Second season, we need a striker and we got Jean-Kevin Augustin. Throughout all of them, we needed more cover in midfield and we just never bothered. It was just Mateusz Klich, hopefully we'll be fine. But it feels like this year people have gone, okay, yeah.
Yeah, there was a lack of insurance, wasn't there?
And we've gone out we needed a fullback and we've gone out in January and got someone who was in the team of the Championship last year. And you go, yeah, all right, this all seems perfectly sensible.
You know, we were saying, quite nice if they signed a left back. I mean, what would have been the point up until now? Would the left back have played? I don't think they would. You got Byram on the bench, who, if Firpo isn't available for Watford, will come into the team. It's not as if whoever could have been signed in January would be playing ahead of him, because Farker thinks an awful lot of Byram. And looking back at January now, what else really would you have done apart from a right back? You know, you're still looking at Creswell getting basically 0 minutes this season. Cooper hardly playing, Ampadu in that position. Strike. You very much got the vibes from Farker on Friday that he suspects that Strike might need to go for surgery. Now, obviously, they've still got to make that decision. But I think when you start talking like that, saying next 10 days will be decisive and everything else, you get the vibe that that might well be happening. But even if Strike, given that there are 8 games to go, even if Strike was to come back now, it's really hard to see him playing, because I just don't see him breaking up this these centre-backs that he's got at the moment.
Yeah, and too good. 10 days brings us round to the end of March, and, you know, that gives us, what, 5 weeks until the end of the season. There's no point in taking the risk, is there? Especially when we've actually, and it's no fault of Pascal Strauss, but we've looked better with him out of the side because of what Ampadu and Rodon have done.
Well, it's that weird thing, isn't it? If you take Pirro out of the team, and I think Leeds have looked better for that with Bamford in it. He's quite quiet today, Bamford, I thought, but, you know, so still did enough. You lose Strike, you have to shift Ampadu out of midfield. And again, like you say, you certainly don't look any worse for it. And the defensive record as it is at the moment, it's not just, you know, the number of goals that are going in. It's the number of, it's the quality of chances they're giving away, which are very, very low. You know, it's not that like teams are creating lots of big chances against them. Not that many shots on goal against them. Very, very few shots on target comparatively to the rest of the division. It's the actual stats that tell you that defensively they're very, very good.
I'd really like us now, just to come back after the break, obviously free of any additional injuries from the internationals, and just keep winning.
Yeah, yeah.
And just
win the last eight games.
Lads, and just go out there and make it look easy for me, just for once, please, in my lifetime, so I can look back and say there was that season when everything was just very, very chill.
The wins have been... They have been pretty chill, haven't they?
Very tense.
There's not an awful lot of back and forth on them, is there? Where, I suppose the Preston game went to the wire, didn't it? We needed the late winner in that.
I think that's been one of the most critical games of the season.
And Leicester was fairly insane. But the rest of the run has generally felt like quite regulation wins.
Like, even the nerves today against Millwall were kind of inspired by a sort of Leeds United PTSD, if you like, thinking back to historic times when we've blown it and... you kind of expect them to do it again. You know, people will always cite what happened against bloody Wigan over Easter in the first Bielsa season. You go, oh, well, you never know. That might just be the train that's coming down the track towards us again.
I'm not even sure there was any bigger picture stuff to it today. I just think people could see that Millwall were getting into the game and were thinking, well, it's only 1-0. So if they score, it's a problem. What I did think was funny was, even though the game was quite clearly won in injury time, that sort of palpable fear among the crowd, or that sort of little nervousness, everybody knowing that if Millwall scored, you'd drop down to second. It really makes a massive difference. But, you know, psychologically, I do think it's pretty important. But it's quite rare to see that when you know the game's done, but everybody's a bit anxious about Millwall, you know, pushing up and committing men forward and everything else. But they deserved it today. And yeah, I mean, I do think the night when I thought they looked like they're going up with Swansea, because that was just that totally steamroller Swansea down there, and what I thought could be quite a difficult game, a horrible night as well. But I think the result that really, really opened the door to my promotion being possible was the Preston game. That late goal from Pirro. I honestly think everybody would have come away from that if it had been 1-1 thinking it's going to be the playoffs, because Leeds are doing too much of what they were doing before Christmas, which is dropping points here and there, and not all the time, but regularly enough to mean that the lead above them was a problem. But from that point, they really have motored.
It's been great, hasn't it? And let's hope it just continues. Another eight games, that's all we ask. So we're going to take a break now over the international break. We'll come back with a show to preview the Watford and the Hull games. Then we'll come back after the long Easter weekend and see where we are then. But it's another tick in the box, isn't it, in the positive column. And while people will enjoy the spoils of going top, we all know, I think, all of us, that there's still a long way to go yet. So we don't get carried away.
Oh, it was cheesecake as well, wasn't it? It was cheesecake for Farker.
Yeah, was it Graham who asked that one?
Yeah, just as he was going out on Friday.
We didn't find out whether that what flavour it is. I'm thinking classic New York.
Yeah, I think so.
But are you having berries with it, a little coolie on the side, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I reckon so. Aye.
But these are the questions that need to be answered.
Yeah, yeah. Next time.
Next time. There's always a next time. Right, Phil, Michael, cheers, right.
Thank you.
Enjoy the international break. Phil, we'll catch up before Watford, yeah?
Excellent.
See you soon.
The Square Ball Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.